All right, I want to welcome to the show my very, very, very special guest, a person who I admire greatly for her multi-hyphenate skills in all sorts of different areas, and I'm going to ask her about all sorts of those things. Please welcome Marissa Morby.
Hi.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Happy to have you. I should only invite Oregon people to the podcast, I feel like, mm-hmm. from now on. I did have a few from outside, but it feels nice to be talking to an Oregon person.
Yeah, I mean.
Exactly. No faking. I'm going to start with a question that isn't even on the list. Are you from Oregon originally?
No, I'm okay. Not. I am originally from Utah.
Okay.
And then I lived in Virginia for a while. Traveled around for a few years. Went to Austin for a couple of years. And then came to Oregon. I was in Oregon in between there for a few years also.
Nice.
That's where we obviously ultimately ended up. So.
Love it.
Our families are here though, which is nice.
That's great. Yeah. That's very nice. I'm trying to, drag our families out here, but they haven't bit on that yet. But
harangued them for a few years, and eventually, I feel like if you're stubborn enough and just keep repeating it, they get tired of fighting.
Totally.
And then they just don't want to hear it anymore, so they'll move.
I love that. I'm going to take that advice, definitely. I think, we had my husband's family come in an ice storm last December, and they're like, we're not coming ever again, so we need a summer visit to erase the memory.
Late spring, early summer, and then they forget, and they're like, oh, Oregon summer is the best summer I've ever seen in my life, which is true.
This is true.
And then they forget that there is also winter.
Let's just erase everyone's memory and also be very stubborn. I have all the tips. I love it. That's amazing. So tell me a little bit about your background and how you found your way into these tech jobs that you've had.
Yeah. So I started out, you say multi-hyphenate, and I love that phrase. And also, it's very true. I actually started out doing human resources at a sporting goods company. It was like a multinational sporting goods company. Mm-hmm. And I was an HR manager there for a few years. I found it very difficult. There's just a lot of things that don't sit well with me in HR. And I myself had to do a few layoffs, and it was horrible. It's horrible for everyone. I got really physically ill from doing it. So I had a lot of, physical issues while I was working there. So I was like, I think I can't do this anymore.
But forever.
Exactly. But what I loved about it was getting to talk to people, getting to interview and learn about people and understand kind of what made them tick, what they liked and didn't like. I like people. I like talking to people, and people seem to like talking to me. So that eventually led me down the path of research, where I started learning more about UX design, UX research, and I picked up some freelance clients while I was traveling about, oh my goodness, it's 10 years ago now. Oh, it's so long.
It's hard to look back at those things that seem like yesterday. And then count.
it was 2014. Wow. Anyway, so 10 years ago, when I was getting into it, I was looking at UX research, UX design. I was able to get a couple clients, small business clients, and in order to fix the design and content on their website, I started talking to their customers, and I really enjoyed it. I was able to figure out, a lot of things that we could fix, that things we both knew and didn't know. And that led me more in the direction of UX research. And then from doing that, I started working at an agency that was really data heavy. So it was like an optimization agency that was really focused on data. And I love data. I love being able to map where gaps are happening and see. It's like, I love the idea of just seeing all data in one place and being able to parse it, especially if you've got data scientists with you, you can parse it and figure out what's happening. I find that really fun. It's a really fun puzzle. But I also think that the qualitative aspect, that idea of pulling in people's needs and wants and how they live their lives and how they're interacting with the product, is also really important. So anyway, at that agency, I ended up bringing in a qualitative research aspect, created a research arm there, and led that department. And it was really cool. Like, we were able to really merge the quantitative data and the qualitative research and create these really great stories, and have like a huge impact at the companies we worked with. So anyway, yeah. And then I got further into tech, into more dev tooling, and yeah, was last at Netlify doing a lot of work on developer tooling, and talking the last several years, been talking pretty exclusively with developers and research. So yeah.
Cool. So that role is a lot of interviewing, I would assume, and you can use your good people skills for that. What other types of tasks does that role typically involve for people who might not know?
Yeah, there is a lot of interviewing. So it's usually I'm on the other side of this conversation where I'm asking the questions.
Turning the tables on you today and doing it worse than you. Yeah.
But so yeah, it's a lot of interviewing. It's a lot of storytelling, which I think people maybe don't realize. So in my mind, research and design are really very closely enmeshed, and they're both heavily based on storytelling. So you are talking with people, and then you are finding themes in the people that you're talking with, and then you have to take that and advocate for the person, the group that you're talking to and about, internally. And that advocacy requires a really good amount of storytelling, because you're trying to distill down, in some cases, conversations that I had over 6 years into a cohesive, short, captivating statement that will bring people in the company on board with you and help push the product in the correct direction for the users that you're trying to help. So yeah, there's a lot of storytelling. There's actually a lot more UX design than at least for me, I've always also done design with my research. I love prototyping, and I love creating prototypes. I love creating like system maps. I love creating workflows. So I pull all that in and create those as a way, one, to show how systems work, because I think understanding a whole system and where people fit into it is really important. And also to help create a kind of single source of truth and common knowledge, so that we're speaking the same language. So research requires that storytelling, that the visual aid to kind of bring people together onto the same page. And in my work, I've always looked at it as a way of bringing in people throughout the company, because I've always sat on design teams, but you're always having to pull in product and developers and marketing. And so there's all these different departments that you're pulling in. So being able to also talk across the company, across different teams, and having enough knowledge that you know what you're talking about, but not try to tell people exactly how they should solve a problem.
Yeah. I love the storytelling aspect of that. That makes so much sense to me. I think about a lot with like teaching, and that's sort of the same idea. You're kind of teaching people why their product is being received in a certain way, or things that people don't necessarily know. So I hadn't thought about it like that. That's really cool.
I mean, to me, research and design is your main goal is to advocate for the user. Like, you are the voice of the user within your company. And so in order to do that, I think you have to craft a really compelling story, because stories are what move us, both like emotionally and like actually physically move us to do things. So
yeah, totally. Yeah, that gets my head turning on that. I could talk to you about storytelling stuff all day. I feel like I'll cut all this out. But do you have an example of a project that you were using research and it went particularly well, or it made a huge impact on the organization that you might want to share?
Yeah, I have two. Can I give two and then you can?
I think so. Yeah. I think we'll allow it. Sure.
So I think the first one I would say was at the agency I was at before, so Clearhead. And that was that data optimization agency where we were doing that data work and doing basically design work to optimize for our clients, the different needs of our clients. So in that, I started doing some qualitative research with the product management I was doing. I was basically like in between an account manager and a product manager when I first started there. And so it was, you know, managing the client relationship and also doing helping with some of the design work and figuring out what type of optimization testing we wanted to do. And as we were doing that, I also started doing some research with our clients' customers, because I felt like there was this question of like, well, why are they doing these things that wasn't answered in the data? We knew what they were doing. We knew how they were doing certain things, but why? And so to me, I was like, that feels like a really important question that we should attempt to answer. And so anyway, so I started doing research with some of these customers of our clients. And in doing that, that gave both me and a few of the other people I was working with that also had the more qualitative background, this standing where we could say, look at the difference in results when we include research on these projects versus not. We had like this very stark comparison. And so it became really clear that adding qualitative research into data-focused changes actually made these huge impacts. So that was when we started creating this research arm at the agency. So I would say that was the first one where research was actually a strategic decision that ended up adding an entire new product line to the company and an entire new offering. And, you know, I ended up building out the research product line as well. We call it product, but it's like product as a service.
Yeah.
And so I ended up building out that as well. So like, what are the offerings? How can we go? Do we want to go broad or do we want to go deep? And how do we decide what to do based on your customer needs or client needs? So that was one. And then I would say the other one was at Netlify, where I'd been working with developers and interviewing developers for probably 4 years or so before I started working at Netlify. Yeah. Because I did client work that was really developer focused, and then worked in-house that was at a framework company that was really developer focused. And anyway, so having all that information, I started to see patterns over the course of a few years that kept coming up. And collaboration between developers and marketing and design was really difficult. Like the engineering department, marketing and design departments all had to have a say in what was happening. Mm-hmm. But engineers always ended up at the end of the line with the push to finish. And it was like, well, I needed these changes in a reasonable time frame. I need to know what changes are still relevant. And I need to know, like, where are these changes supposed to be happening? And what I heard over and over was that there was not a streamlined way of doing this. Mm-hmm. That engengineers were having to take information from Slack, email, sometimes phone calls, they got pulled into a meeting, they were like writing it down. So there were these disparate areas where they were having to pull this information and actually make these changes. They didn't always know if the changes were still relevant based on new things that had happened that they weren't aware of. And so anyway, it led me to work on a collaboration tool at Netlify for companies that were either larger and had really large engineering, marketing, and design departments, or for agencies where they were having to have a lot of back and forth between the engineering and the client. So yeah, and that one was like probably 4 or 5 years of research condensed down into a cohesive statement that we could then work from. So
totally. Yeah. That's so cool. So you were working, I think the nature of what you do on these projects is kind of work with so many different people. Yeah. How does that work? How do you get everybody bought into what you're doing and show them? I know like the money is a great thing to show people, or metrics, things like that. But on a personal level, I think you have like a good personality for making people want to talk to you. So are there any tips you'd give for getting everybody on board?
Yes, I think metrics are good if you've got them, and they can be very compelling. They can be compelling from a look at my slide, see why this is good, like the numbers are very clear. But from a tips from a non-data standpoint, if you don't have metrics, or if it's something that you know you should do but haven't invested in doing, that's where one, storytelling comes in. Mm-hmm. And two, when I get people bought in, I am very big on getting other people in the room in the interview. So when you have research participants, you want to create a safe space where they feel like they can actually tell you what they're doing, and they need to feel like they need to feel safe, basically. And so, but I do like to get other people in the room. So I like to get engineers, product, marketing, design, whoever is going to touch the project that we're working on or answering questions about, I like to get them into the room in the call with us, because that is emotionally compelling to hear someone talk about their struggle. Mm-hmm. Or it's really great I say great, it's not great for the person doing the thing, but like when you can watch someone struggle with something that you've created, there is so much amazing feedback you get from that. And it really does make people want to improve what we're working on. So bringing them into that conversation early and then having them come back. And it's really fun because a lot of times people are kind of like, oh, I don't really want to go to the thing. It's like a meeting. No, I get it. It is. It's a meeting. And you got to sit there and watch the thing. But a lot of times after people have come to one of the research interviews, they ask me to come back mm-hmm. and listen in on more. And sometimes like they want to ask questions. And so I can help them think about what a good question looks like, because we don't talk a lot about that. There are a lot of ways to ask the same thing, and there are a lot of really bad ways to ask something.
Totally. I love that. Interviewing people always is a cool way to make people feel like they have a voice in what's going on too. So I feel like mm-hmm. That's a good thing too. So I used the word multi-hyphenate before, and I kind of blew it early. I had my $1,000 word ready earlier in the thing. So I feel like a lot of tech people tend to talk about tech all the time and do tech things all the time. And then you ask them about other stuff and they lock up. But you are a ceramics expert, an artist, a chef, a community builder, a sustainability community builder and champion, and lots more things too. How do you think about all of these different kind of interests of yours. And like, for example, you started, you can tell me more about it, the sustainability initiative at Netlify, for example, and you're, it seems like you're thinking about ways of taking these interests and skills of yours and applying them to these tech jobs. Is that a question? Maybe not, but you know what I mean.
I think it was a question. It, sure. it was a statement. I can expand.
You're the interviewer, not me.
Yes, I think of tech as one piece of a lot of other things that I do.
Yeah.
And in terms of sustainability, I think it all kind of boils down to the fact that I am more of a systems thinker. My maybe base passion, or like the thing that I find most amazing, is ecology.
Yeah.
And ecology is just a complex natural system of which we mostly don't understand. We understand some of it, but there's these cause and effect things that we see year after year as we, you know, as scientists are studying, oh gosh, it goes so deep. But as scientists are studying different areas of the natural sciences, we learn how things are interconnected in ways that we never imagined or understood or dreamed of. But it all boils down to things living within a system, right? And so for me, we live within that system. And so sustainability is not something that is separate. It's not something that you go over here and do sometimes. We need oxygen to live.
Interesting.
Water to live and food to live. And all of that requires that we have a planet on which to do that. And we are the only known livable planet in the universe right now. And humans aren't anywhere else that we know of. So to me, it's not this separate thing. It's like this, it's just a core issue to being alive. And I like being alive and would like to stay that way for as long as I can. And so to me, bringing that into my daily job is, it's just something that makes complete sense. Yeah. Because we're part of a larger system. And I think that we can all push toward different sustainability in the work that we do. There are ways to run programs that are less intense. There are ways to decrease our carbon output. There are things that we can do that improve change or lessen our impact. Mm-hmm. And I think bringing that sustainability into where you work is a really great way to start. And it's not perfect, and it's never going to be perfect, but I think that it's going to grow as we start to see more climate-focused initiatives passing in government. We're going to see more and more of this. And so to me, every job can be a climate and sustainability job. It's just in the way you look at it, but we're all part of the system. So we have to do what supports us as like a species.
As people being alive on the planet. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that's so useful. And yeah, your Twitter, whatever it's called, feed these days is a great place to learn about all sorts of different city planning and community building things and climate change and all of that. And your newsletter, Design and Nature Reimagined, right?
Yeah.
Is part of that too. So how did you start thinking about writing about these topics and get started there?
I got started out of abject fear.
Got it.
Yep. I read a lot of climate research, which is probably unsurprising to anyone either listening or who has seen any of my stuff. I read a lot of climate research, And I am fascinated with, like I said, ecology and natural systems. And if you've read any climate research, it's really scary. It's really, really scary. And so I started the newsletter as a way to think about nature in a hopeful and joyful manner. I fear, psychologically, fear is a great motivator for a while. It is. It's, you know, it's been proven over and over. Like, you can really get someone moving with fear, but you can't keep them going, because there comes a point where their brain can't take it anymore, and they have to shut it off. They have to numb themselves. And when you numb it, when you numb that fear, you numb everything. You can't feel anything anymore. You don't get to just numb emotions one at a time. So to me, I know that we need this information. We have to understand where we are so that we can make changes. But if we are constantly in fear, we will do nothing. And so I started the newsletter as a way to look not at climate, but at nature from a really hopeful and joyful standpoint, and to highlight people that were connecting nature in different ways that we maybe hadn't seen, in a hope to pique people's curiosity, to make them feel more connected with nature, to make them want to go out and try something new that maybe they hadn't before. When I write that newsletter, like, it makes me personally feel very good, because I'm just talking about things I'm interested in or that I find cool, yeah, or that I think is important. And so the newsletter has stuff ranging from, like, my last article was on biomaterials, which are basically medical devices, and how we're starting to learn a little bit of, like, not biomimicry, but we're using 3D printing and the ability to isolate certain minerals within the body to, like, 3D print bone, which is fascinating.
That's cool.
And then my article before that was about photography, nature photography and art. So it's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. I love that. And I think it's so important to show those cool things and the hopeful nature of things, because, yeah, sometimes people feel like, well, there's no point of anything because we can't, I'm only one person, what can I actually do? But you can do kind of a lot. And your newsletter does a lot to educate people on that too. So thanks. Exponential. So science. I'm going to stop there because that's where my information is gone. So something I wanted to make sure to talk to you about is, I've seen you in so many videos and performance things, and you are so funny and such a good actor. I'm always like, dang, she's doing it again. Like, she's really good in this. Facial expressions are always so funny. Like, you're doing a lot. So you have to have some background in theater stuff, right?
Yes. I was a theater kid for many, many years. When I first went to college, I actually went for vocal performance. I'm a singer, so yeah. I did that for several years. So yeah, I did theater camps. I don't know. I really enjoy it.
Totally. But, and that comes through, and I think that what you do in those is, like, take these topics that people want to present as super boring and make them really fun. So there's a lot of impact there.
I think being goofy and funny is a huge impact. I don't think I'm funny. I think I'm goofy, which I'll take. You know,
I disagree, but I I think you are very, very funny. Yeah, if you haven't seen some of those videos, they are so good. And are you working on anything right now? I'm sure, maybe you can't talk about it.
Oh, no, not right now. No, not right now. I think the main thing that I'm working on that's video oriented, I record some of my ceramic stuff, which is not funny. It's more, honestly, probably falls more into just, like, calming.
Yeah. ASMR, yeah.
ASMR videos and cooking shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so mad because the ceramic, the little vase that I have downstairs, I didn't bring up here. I'm very angry at myself, but I'm gonna put it here in post. I'm gonna point right there. Because it's really, really cool. And you've also put these, you mentioned it just there, but that cooking show that you're working on is really cool too. Tell me how that came to be.
So Jason, my husband and I love to cook.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's one of the things that we've learned to do together, I think, is cook.
Cool.
I don't know that either of us kind of came into the relationship as great cooks, but we've like evolved. That's like a shared hobby. And so we love cooking, we love having people over, we love hosting. We started doing a cooking show where we talk about or try recipes, talk about what we're cooking, how we're cooking it, ideas around cooking. And I honestly think it's just because we enjoy cooking together.
Yeah.
And so we've got a nice setup for it. So we thought, why not? We enjoy doing it. So.
Totally. I love that. For someone who's a person who gets overwhelmed by hosting like me, what's a good hosting tip? Do you have a, yeah.
I actually like hosting bigger parties
Yeah.
because I can be a control freak. And so if I host a bigger party, I can't control the situation, and that releases me from my neuroticism.
I love that. That's great.
In some weird way, it does. So when we have parties with like a few people, like 8 people,
Yeah.
I'm like, I gotta make it perfect. But if we have parties with 20, 30 people, I'm like, oh, there's no way that I can
No
do
control in
that.
this.
So
Yeah.
I just, let it go. And so I would say that is another thing. Like, if you're nervous about it, find your area where you feel like you can't make it perfect and invite
Yeah.
that many people.
That's really good. We had about 20 over for Christmas Eve, and that's how I felt. I was just like, there's no controlling this.
Yeah,
You're so right.
it is what
Yeah,
it
smaller groups, that's everything. That's so good. Thank sorry for taking us off topic. I'll cut
Oh
back.
no, that
But
was a
thank you for that. That's super interesting. Yeah, I struggle with that. We always had like the house we were renting before was so small, so I would never have like dinner parties,
Yeah,
and now I kind of
you can.
can, and it's like, ugh,
For dinner parties, I will say, so that doesn't stress me out anymore. And the reason is I have learned to just, because I know that I need to control stuff,
yeah.
I find one thing that I have complete control over and I pour my neuroticism into that thing. And then
Pour it
there's
in, spirit,
huh?
yeah.
Yeah. Or the dish, whatever I'm making. And then I physically have no more capacity to do neuroticism everywhere else.
I love
So
it.
and then I ask other people to bring stuff, and I know that my thing is going to be what I need it to be, and I just like channeling that anxiety directly into that cake. And wow, it tastes good, but it is an anxiety cake.
You can't taste the anxiety once it's cooked, but yeah.
Tastes like sweetness, there's a lightness to it.
Absolutely. The
Very good.
flavor avoids the anxiety
Yeah,
taste.
exactly.
Not infused. That's so funny. Oh man. Okay. Well, Marissa, it's been so nice talking to you. Anything else you want to plug before we wrap here? That could be literally anything, a kitchen gadget, a
Oh.
work thing, a
I
whatever, a movie.
would say the only thing I'll plug is if you enjoy reading about nature and design and sometimes tech stuff and but nature in general, sign up for Design and Nature Reimagined. There's a lot of cool things in there that you, I'm guessing, might not know.
Love it. Well, thank you so much. You're so smart and cool and just the best. So, thank you for doing this. And we will see you next time on the Last Tech Podcast. Thanks, Marissa.
Thanks for having me.
We did it. The Last Tech Podcast.